So if you happen to be a game developer from Munich, you probably remember Mimimi Games. Luca Martinelli worked there with Unity, like many studios. But now he's working at Bippin Bytes with Godot and on titles like PVKK or Domekeeper. So they know a bit about Unity and Godot and what makes the difference. And they know a bit about productivity. And that's what Luca's now talk about. Please welcome Luca Martinelli.
Yeah, thank you very much for coming. Thank you for the introduction. So today we'll talk about productivity. I'll get into it in a second. It will start a bit theoretical, abstract, but I will get very concrete and I'll get into our details. A bit about myself. Somebody on the website said I'm a productivity and workflow expert. I have no clue what that means, but it's the perfect LinkedIn bio, so I'll use that from now on. In reality, I'm a game designer and a developer. I consider myself a programmer. I consider myself a designer. And I try to be a generalist, but it's hard. Until 2023, I was working at Mimimi here in Munich. It's actually just a few minutes from here, very nostalgic. And we worked on a nice game called Shadow Gambit. But as we heard, it wasn't Unity. This is where you can boo. Then when the company shut down, it was around the time where Unity had some issues. And like everybody else, I turned to the prettier girl and tried to chase it. Afterwards, I had this great opportunity to join Bippin Bytes and get to work on Domekeeper post-launch on all the new content that we added. And this really gave me the opportunity to transfer to Godot, new engine, straight into a released product, a production-ready product, which never had these like foundational concepts from Unity and used Godot in its, kind of in a different way, a way I wasn't used to. And by now, I get to work on PVKK, Planetenverteidigungskanonenkommandant, which is a great opportunity to further my knowledge in Godot. Yeah. All right. So what is this talk about? I'm going to talk about productivity. This is going to be the high-level design stuff. And I'm going to move it forward, start get more technical, and talk about how it works in Godot, how it interacts with Godot, why productivity works well in Godot. And finally, I'm going to talk about how we use it at Bippin Bytes and kind of our strategies to take this even further in, with very, very concrete examples. I'm going to air all of our dirty laundry, because that's what you should do. So to reiterate, I'm going to talk about what makes productivity so important, why Godot is so good at it, and how we as a company try to push it even further. Let's talk about productivity. So the formal definition is the rate at which a company or country makes goods. It's a very formal thing, comes from the industry, and it has this beautiful equation. Productivity is just the rate of your output over your input. If we rearrange it, it becomes a little bit more intuitive. It's a measure of speed. It's a multiplier, a scalar on your input. So what is input? Well, in the game development context, it can be anything. It's time, it's people, it's how many hours your employees work, what kind of resources you have. But the one I really want to talk about is productivity only over time. About an individual developer, an individual programmer, designer, an individual person working in engine. And if you look at this equation, some of you will recognize that this is just the equation for speed. So speed, distance is speed over time, or speed times time. And this is what we're talking about. So the productivity is just the speed at which you create an output. To put it into a context, like a games lens, we can take this example and we consider the game development process as kind of trying to climb a hill. You start with nothing or something and you're trying to make a better game. And in this analogy, making a better game is reaching the top. Productivity would be your movement speed, just how fast are you moving. Now, until now I'm talking about general productivity, just speed, just how fast do you do things, how fast does the engine work, what kind of environments, like, yeah, just speed. But the one that we really care about is what I like to call a key productivity, which is not the general speed, but kind of the speed at which you make a game better. So this is a big difference. There's a giant difference between just being fast and being fast at making a game better. In the current situation, we'll know it's important to make good games. Only a small percentage of games actually make it. The amount of games that get released increases, so the pressure on making a good game has increased. Making a mediocre game, average game, just doesn't work out anymore. If we go back to our analogy, normal productivity is just how fast you walk, and the key productivity, making the game better, is kind of how fast you walk towards your destination. It's kind of relative to the point you're going to. In games, that's unclear what it is. In this analogy, it's getting up, reaching the peak. And so they can be very different. For example, there was a time when I started getting good at system development, and I started to gain speed. I started over-engineering I had so much speed, I made everything super complex. I took systems, and then I made the simulations and added more layers and layers and layers. And the reality is that I was faster, so normal productivity was up, but this key productivity was down because the games were worse. The games just weren't playable, they weren't fun. So I was walking, I was moving faster, I was just moving in the wrong direction very often. So how do we make games better, faster? That's kind of the key question for every developer. So there's some kind of naive interpretation or emotional responses that often happen. One is just by making better predictions. You work on a system, it takes you 3-4 iterations, and at the end you say, how could I have made this faster? How could I have made this better more quickly? And you go, well, if I made better prediction, I would have gotten this on the first iteration. I would have gotten straight away. And the idea is that, yeah, maybe through experience, you can develop better instincts, get better at making predictions. But the reality is that this is not actionable. This is not how you should think about these kind of processes. It's not how you gain speed, because it's not something you can change quickly. This is something you need to build up over a long time. The other one is making less mistakes. It's the same thing. You build a system, then months later, you get a bug. You spend 3 days fixing that bug, and you think, how could I have done this better? Just don't write that bug. It's the same thing, yeah, long term with experience, with time, you get better at this. It's really about understanding the space. If you've made a game in the genre before or in the space before, you're less likely to repeat this. But it's not actionable. This is not the kind of thing you should work on. If you're in that position, you spend a whole day fixing a bug, the solution was not to not have the bug. That won't happen. So the one I want to talk about is by getting faster in general. It's a little bit weird, because I just said, you know, going fast and making games fast is not the same, actually can even lead you the wrong way. And this is kind of the key of my talk and what I really want to talk about. I think by just getting better at going fast in general, how you work, how you use your tools, just the micro, you're just going to make better games. You're going to get better at making better games in general. All right. So, to talk about this, I need to talk about the Flash. So the Flash has the superpower. His superpower is just to be fast. It's perfect in our analogy. But if you think about the Flash and you think about what he actually does, he has a set of other superpowers that come from being fast that are actually more important than him being fast. For example, he can run up walls. This is just a consequence. There's some others where he just shakes his hands and creates tornadoes out of his arms. And the one that most of us know is that he can time travel. So his power is speed, but the consequence of it is he can time travel, and that's the way more exciting superpower. So I have kind of 5 hidden superpowers of tapping into the speed force that come from just getting faster. The first one is that you get resilient against the sunk cost fallacy. Does everybody know what the sunk cost fallacy is? Yeah? Raise your hands if you... All right. There's a definition here, but the thing we care about is that sunk cost comes from an investment of money, time, and effort. It is not a metric of time. It is a metric of time. And what this means is that if you are being faster, kind of the pressure, the impact of the sunk cost fallacy is reduced. So in a way, you build a form of resistance. You're less likely, you're less prone to fall for it. And this means you're going to take less bad decisions that are driven by the sunk cost fallacy. You know, often we call this kill your darlings. And so being fast makes you better at killing your darlings. Being fast allows you to make mistakes. Exploring the space you're in design-wise, it's a lot about the cost of doing this exploration. If the cost, like the pressure of making a mistake, becomes unbearable or too high, you feel forced into getting things right the first time, you feel forced into not exploring and kind of exploiting the things you already know. And this is very counterproductive in a world, in a kind of discipline that's very dynamic, where it's really about, you will make mistakes. So it's really about kind of accepting the fact that you will make mistakes, working from them, and also using the fact that you make mistakes to understand the space you're in better. So you can make mistakes, which is very positive, thanks to speed. The third one, I mean, this is the obvious one, we don't really need to talk about it. If you're faster, you can do more iterations. If you've seen René talk yesterday, you know the importance of iteration speed being the key of kind of development nowadays. Being fast, more iterations in a very concrete way in kind of agile development leads to better result. You just end up iterating, end up, you know, trying different things, make mistakes, shifting your priority. And so just by being fast, you have the time to make more iterations, and this will lead to better game design without needing to be a better game designer. This is a bit of a controversial one, but one of the more important ones. Being fast makes you more experienced faster. So it goes back to the equation, where does experience come from? Well, experience, in the definition, is a result of effort and work. It is not a unit of time. So you're not experienced because you did something for 10 years in the sense that 10 years have passed. You're experienced because in those 10 years, you've done something very often, a lot, repetitively. It goes back to exploration. You got the opportunity to explore a space, so when you can come back with a problem that is in the same space, you have witnessed it before, you've kind of felt it before. And by being faster, you end up doing more things, which in the same regard allow you to explore more and lead you to be more experienced. And this goes back to the points I said before about making better predictions, making less mistakes in general. So suddenly being fast does approach those two solutions in a very positive way. The last one, and maybe the most important one, being fast is just more fun. And this is not to be underestimated, because kind of velocity, productivity, moving in game development is one of the most important aspects. You know, you want to feel good, you want to get in a state of flow, continue kind of your positive development cycle. It creates a positive feedback loop. And so this is like scientifically proven. Short reward cycles increase short-term enjoyment. Kind of just shortening the time between you start something and you get positive feedback for it, or negative feedback if you're good at dealing with it, just makes the experience more exciting, more positive. It makes, more enjoyable. So quick summary of productivity. It's the speed at which you create an output in the context of time. The key productivity, the thing we should really care about, is that speed at which we make games better. These don't align, they're not the same thing, but being faster because of these hidden powers that come with it is actually one way to increase the important productivity, this key productivity. So let's get into Godot and why I'm holding this talk. So after I moved away from Unity and I meet my old colleagues and people I knew from the Unity scene, they always ask me, how's it going in Godot? Do you like it? How is it? And my answer is always, I love it, because it's so fast. and it makes me so productive that even though I'm in a language that I'm not used to, I worked in C# 6-7 years before now working in GDScript, I'm faster in GDScript than I was in C# very, very quickly. For example, the first game jam we made was my first day of work. I've only written a week of GDScript, and I was at least as fast as after 5 or 6 years of C#. And this is a big power. So how do we make games better faster? By getting faster in general. And the one I want to talk about for Godot is by just reducing time wasted by the tools and the engine. So let's break it down. Let's get a little bit concrete. What does the normal feature development loop look like? Well, you make the feature, you ship it. All right, what does it mean? Well, you have a concept, then you make an MVP, And then you do some iterations, and then you ship it. And yeah, okay. You make a concept, an MVP, an iteration, a second iteration, a third iteration, fourth iteration. You make a build, you send it to QA, they test it, get it back to you, you fix the 700 bucks you just added, and you ship it. So it's getting very minute, and we're going to come to why the engine is important. If we look at one iteration, which realistically is the biggest part of our time, the kind of the most important part of our time, and also the part where we do our work, we do the things we're good at, and we break it down further, well, it gets interesting. So, okay, you do the planning for the iteration. You boot up the project. People always forget the step. It's a big step. You make some changes. This is where you actually write code or make assets. This is your job. Then you compile. If you see that, you know where I'm going with this. You run the project. You test it. You find some bugs, so you bug fix. You compile again. You test it again. You run the project. You test it again. All right, now you realize you're not done because that's not how we work. We don't implement a whole feature in one shot. You need to do a pass on it. In an iteration, you do many iterations. So you make some changes, you compile, you run the project, you test it, you bug fix. Then you compile, run the test, and test it to test the fix of the bug fix. And you do it again. And until we get to the part that's interesting, then you make a build, send it to QA in the kind of cycle we work in. Finally, do some kind of higher level testing with your team, with external players, whatever. So if we look at this, which is what our day actually looks like, and I color code it, there's a bit of a pattern. So the green things is what I call kind of skill base. This is where this is our job. The red things is just the engine and the framework you're in. This is most of the time has nothing to do with you and everything to do with how you're working. And the blue things, well, are kind of a bit of both. You know, testing is about, obviously, how quick you are at testing, but it's also about how well you can test in the engine, how many like you have tools to kind of prepare this, how much time is just wasted doing nothing. The metaphor I like to say is that everything that's red, and which is also half of the blue, is a cooldown between your actual job and the next time you get to do your job. So you can be an amazing programmer, artist, designer, whatever, if you're working in engine, and be really, really good, have this OP skill, and then just go on cooldown for the next kind of 50% of your work. And if you take this, compress it back to the slide from before, and look at this from the large side, yeah, it's really, obviously this is not proportional. I didn't get to measure it, which I want to do, and compare the engines, but this is for the next time. You actually don't work a lot when you work. Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of red. And what this means is that the engine and tools, the environment you're in, matter for speed as much as your skill. And now we finally get to talk about Godot, because there's some nodes in there that maybe you wouldn't consider for Godot. So this is kind of the industry standard. This is the Unity Unreals. And this is, you know, in part, Godot with C#. And then we look at Godot with GDScript. Ta-da! So what is happening? Well, our boot time is down, and that looks minor, but I have a nice story for this. I went to visit a friend a few years ago who works in a big AAA Unreal project, and he will start his day by waking up, going to his computer, pulling from the repository we're in, clicking play, and then going to have breakfast for an hour, because it took an hour to get into playtime the first time they run. And this is a common thing. This is not like a one-off. This is what game development looks like on the higher levels. In Godot, in PVKK, I don't know, 5 seconds, 10 seconds, I don't know, because it's so short. The second time that is gone, which is the most important one, there's no compile time. You make your changes, you're done. This is the most frequent cooldown in Unity. When I was at MimiMi on Shadow Gambit, or kind of compile, well, it's not compile, whatever, domain reload, whatever you want to call it in C#, was about 45 seconds. And we spent a lot of time getting it down to 45 seconds. It was like a, I don't know, 500 or 300,000 lines of code base. It has a lot of things happening. And most of the time, as a programmer or as a designer, the changes you make are minimal. You change 2 lines of code. It's like 17 seconds of work, followed by a minute and a half cooldown on your skill. And the third one, equally important, the runtime. How long are you, after the compilation, you click play, what's your wait time here? And this can easily be minutes in larger projects. But in Godot, it tends to be extremely fast. And I'll talk back about this when we talk about PBKK and our projects. Another thing you might notice is that, actually, let me look at time, all right. Another thing you might notice is that there's a whole iteration chunk missing after the first pass. So when I showed it earlier, you would run your first test, find bugs, stop playing, fix the bugs, recompile, rerun, test. But with GDScript and the amazing implementation of hot reload, you actually don't do this. You test the first time, find the bug, open the code, fix the bug, you're still in game, you get to test that the bug fix works. This is 90% of the bugs. And you just keep going. So you're skipping this doubling of the compilation and running time by just using this amazing feature that's the core of the engine. So if you look at it, well, that's a very good improvement. And the amount of time I'm actually working has gone up significantly. And so this goes to, you know, the name of the talk, the superpower of Godot, as I like to call, or that I just came up with, Godot is Triforce. Having a primary language with no compilation time. I'm interested here, how many here use Godot with C#? Yeah, so that 20%, okay, that's less than I expected. And the rest is all GDScript? Can I get a raise hands for GDScript? Oh, I love it. I don't even need to hold a talk. I specify primary programming language because you have scenarios like Unreal with I immediately forgot what the feature is called, the node-based scripting. Blueprints, thank you, which is an amazing, amazing way to program. But there is a massive difference between a system that's built to support versus a system, obviously, yeah, Godot's main language is C++, but the user language is GDScript, and it's going to continue to be the way that everything that is ported to kind of user land, to developer land, will be supported in GDScript. And this means, kind of contrary to blueprints, that you're not forced to sometimes go, I now need an expert C++ programmer. There are some reasons to do it, and it's always great to have that possibility. But the fact that it's the core and it's still text-based is a very, very significant difference. The second one, I've talked about it. This is it. This is Godot. Seamless and instant hot reload takes away a third of your cooldown. It's the greatest upgrade you can buy. And the last one, again, fast launch, play, and export times. On PBKK right now, our build pipeline, which includes automatic testing and upload to Steam, is about 30 minutes. It's not amazing, but that's like, okay, take a lunch break. At MimiMi, it was 8 hours. So the only way to get a build was to wait for the build for the next day. And actually, without the build pipeline, if you run it locally and you have the cache already prepared and everything, this can be like a minute. And it happens more often than you think that you just need to make a build, do bug fixing, make a build, do bug fixing, or QA has some requirements. And bringing that iteration time down as well is as important as the other two. All right. The mythical 10x developer in context. Does somebody not know what the 10x developer is? All right, I'll explain it. So by now, it's a bit of a meme. It comes from computer science production, kind of managing large developer teams. And it's this idea that kind of the bell curve of how fast developers are is a real thing. And there's the normal developer is 100%, one times the speed. And there's some mystical 10x developer that in the same time does 10 times the work. It's become a meme because it's a very unrealistic thing that kind of big tech and Fortune 500 companies kind of use as catchphrases and kind of things to look for, or to justify, like to use as an AI thing. But it's still useful as a reference. So if we take the original thing in a generic engine and we apply we put a 10x developer in it, this is what it looks like. Obviously, yeah, proportionally, it's not correct. But yeah, this is not 10x. And what it means practically is that the better your developers, the kind of the faster, the closer they are to this absurd number, the more the slowdown from your framework or your tools is going to impact your general productivity. You take a 10x developer, these people are probably worth millions. At least in Silicon Valley, these people are worth millions. and you put it in a framework, and he's just on cooldown the whole time. So reducing time wasted by tools and engine matters more the better you get. And this is something that professional developers know, where they get really good at an engine, and they get more and more frustrated with kind of the overhead that takes away from their core productivity. So yeah, look at this if you are in a setup using C#, or in general, or not using hot reload the way you really can. And think about, you fired some amazing people, and now you've just put them on cooldown. How am I doing on time? Okay. The what is the engine doing time? This is another kind of superpower from Godot. A lot of concepts in game engines, because they do so much from so many kind of departments, from mathematics, physics, simulation, everything, is that, engines are really complex. They're very difficult. But the reality is that most of the code in an engine is kind of boilerplate. It's about connections. It's about graph, like dependencies and everything. And the really hard systems, like rendering, et cetera, they're very important, but there's a lot about the engines that you can learn very quickly. So I have this example. Let's say a scenario. You call this function, and there's only one node in your whole tree that is in the group that you're looking for. Who thinks this function is very slow? Can I get a raise of hands? All right. Who thinks it's very fast? Who thinks it's faster than having a reference in another class and you just go something like world.getHandler? Yeah. And the reality is, because we're in Godot and it's open source, step one, you look in the documentation, but actually it says nothing about speed. And the ones of you that come from Unity, they might know that kind of infamous function called get find game object with tag, which used to be, or maybe still is, one of the slowest functions you could kind of use, because it would have to crawl everything. It would do a disaster. And so the first thing you would learn in Unity, never use it. And then you come to Godot, and you go, never use it. And the documentation doesn't tell you, doesn't say anything about it, which is fine, because it's talking about what it does, not how it does it. And the reality is you can just, have Visual Studio or whatever, open up the source code. If you can read C++, you don't need to be able to write it. If you've write C# or have experience with similar languages, you can read the source code to a point that you understand what it's doing. And all you have to do is just kind of take the function name you use in GDScript, search with quotation marks, and you're going to find the binding, so you can just look at the function. And if we actually look at how it's implemented in Godot, it uses a hash map. Everything is cached when you add it to groups, so there's no searching involved. It might be a bit of a misnomer because, it's called get first node and group, so it kind of implies that it's fast. This is kind of a programming principle to maybe name functions that tend to do more complex operations, something like find, which is why in Unity, it was find game object with tag, but here it's get first node and group. But this is a big difference. This means that this function is very fast as long as there's only one node in it, because the moment a lot of nodes are in a group, they get sorted again. So suddenly, the time is very dependent on how you use it. And this is the kind of thing that you can't do in Unity at all, and this costs a lot. And Unreal has you can do it in Unreal, but it has a very, very large code base that is very interconnected. You need to understand a lot of concepts. And I found in my experience that just doing this in Godot, you can understand what a function is doing by just spending 20 seconds and reading at the first kind of 5 to 10 lines of code. And this is really important because the amount of time when making a game, especially when you get closer to release, that you get these problems that are just about not knowing what's happening under the hood, is actually surprisingly high. All right. So this was the point about Godot. We want to move faster. We want to make better games. Going fast in general helps with that. And the way, in regards to tool, the really good way to do it, reduce time wasted on the framework, on the tools you're using. And Godot is really, really good at it. The other way to kind of make games better faster, which is an obvious statement, is just reduce the time you're not making the game faster. But what it means is that there's a lot of things that you can do very quickly that actually have no impact on the game getting better. And if you think about back to productivity in the industry, is how do you increase production speed while you sacrifice quality? And this is something that we often watch at negatively, kind of in that regard. But in terms of games, there's a lot of things you're doing that are not making the game better. They're not for the game. They are for other reasons. You write code architecture for a coding standpoint. You make sure that all of your edges on a drawing are really clean and smooth from an artistic standpoint. From a design point, you try to find kind of the best possible answer. And the reality is that there's a lot of shortcuts, trade-offs, and sacrifices you can take to really kind of feed the big part, the most important part, which is just make the game better, by taking away kind of your pride and your, you know, the love for your job and pushing it into making the game better. And this is really hard because as a programmer, for example, you go to a conference or something like that and you really want to show good code. You want to show clean code. That's what it means to be a good programmer. And the reality is that as a game developer, actually should do the opposite. They should go to a conference and just be, look at how bad this code is. I wrote it in 1 second. That's the magic. So let's go to BibiBits talking about that. and I'm going to talk very concretely about what we do in PPK game. So BibiBits and Godot is very exciting because it, like the core BibiBits team, René and Anna, when they kind of did this move or went there, they didn't come from the Unreal Unity background. They didn't have all of these learnings that come from how those engines work. So they kind of, and came from much smaller, kind of more old school, simplistic engines that didn't come with this kind of burden of knowledge and techniques that you have in those two. And what it means is that they do things very differently than I used to do in Unity, and without kind of the bias of those learnings. So I'm going to go through a few. These first few are not like features or things we build, it's just how we use the engine. The first thing is we do is we just load assets by path in the script, in the middle. We just drag, hold control, drop, done. There's other ways to do it. You can use UUIDs, don't. And you can make an export and then go into the inspector and play Unity for a bit and just take the thing and drop it in. And from a programming standpoint, that's more stable. It creates like independence. And one of the things it does, which happens in bigger companies, is if your level designer comes in and likes to rename the object because that would make sense, and they're not aware about how you build, well, this just breaks the game. And so doing the indirection makes sense in those big engines, maybe. But it's slow, and this is fast. So the advantage, it's incredibly fast. It's incredibly easy to read and debug, and this is why you shouldn't use UUIDs. Because we read this, we know what we're doing, you can control click into it. Yeah, you can do that on UUIDs, but the code tells me everything I need to know about what this execution is doing. If I do indirection with export, actually the variable might not be assigned. So I read the code, it looks perfect, it doesn't run. There's a, you know, missing reference. Or you might have dropped in something wrong. Like, it creates this indirection where you have to go back to the engine, look at the node, look if the reference is correct. You're spending a lot of time for something that could just be there. It's a very old school way of writing, making games, but I think it's the correct way, it's the fast way in Godot for the games that we make. Obviously, we make certain kinds of game. Yeah, everything you know is in code. Do not underestimate the importance of that statement when the programmer and the designer kind of are the same people, or the designer is capable of reading code to a good degree. It makes understanding your code base, even a larger code base, exponentially faster and easier than the other case. So the trade-off, this might feel dirty, and now I have to talk about the feeling of feeling dirty. I'm going to show you these dirty things, and you can think, okay, this is bad programming, and you're right, that's the point. But I really want to think about the thing I'm talking about, the core, which is the only thing that matters is making a better, like making the thing you have and making it better and getting faster at doing that. So making better code or writing good code, this feeling of dirtiness from doing something bad, because this is bad, it's not justified from that perspective. It comes from like this higher level understanding of programming that comes from a software development world where you have 500 people making software that's supposed to run for 40 years or run our banks, run our satellites. But we're making we're making games, we're making broken products. Yeah. So what's the trade-off? So what's the actual cost? Talking about dirtiness, what does it actually cost to do this like ugly thing? Well, yeah, renaming moving assets breaks the game. And renaming moving assets is slower, but if you look at the percentage, you use as like you do this part more than you rename stuff. So, and it's not that much slower. And all you have to do is create the shared understanding that renaming or moving things might impact code execution. All you, like just go through the three steps from every time you want to kind of rename something, do right click, see where it's owned, see the references, maybe search in code if something like this is happening. It's a bit slower, but you need to trust your designers and kind of non-technical people that aren't writing code to understand such a simple pipeline as don't just rename instinctively. And GDScript is pretty good at immediately screaming at you when you do something like this in a bad way. So it's not a high price for something very, very fast. Yeah, we reference node and scenes by unique names. It's the same principle, just move to kind of the in-scene structure. So here you have three choices. You can reference with the like the dollar sign. I have no clue what that's called. You can use the unique names, or you can make an export variable, drag the thing, drop it in. And this is really, really fast. It has the same weakness. If you rename it, breaks. But it has this advantage that every time you see something in the scene tree that has a percent sign, you know you shouldn't rename it. And you can move it. So it's a different weakness. It's much, yeah, it's superior to just the dollar sign. And it's incredibly fast. So very fast, drag and drop, resilient to changes in hierarchy, which is great. And you immediately know where to find a reference. And this is not to be underestimated, because the indirection that brings kind of code stability costs a lot of time. Trade-off, same thing. Renaming can break. It's slower. You just need the shared understanding. Let me get faster. Yeah, we really use hot reload. I've already talked about this before. But very often when programming, you find you get programming challenges. Is this a times one or a times minus one scenario? Do I have to kind of offset? Is this the off by like off, offset by one kind of bug? Or what equation will feel good when I play this? And yeah, there's some if you're really good at programming, maybe you know though, like you can just solve that. But it goes back to the fact that getting really good at that means takes time, takes experience. The other thing you can do is just try, just write some code, run it, use hot reload to just change dynamically. If it's a pickup animation, just write whatever, run it, and go in, just adjust it, tweak it. And this is this happens very often, and it's crazy how much faster this is than the classic method of trying to understand, kind of interpret experience through algorithms and kind of iterating on that. The other thing you can do is obviously use it for assets as well. Just the classic problem was, you know, does it look good when I'm in game and you just move it 50 times or just throw it in and just kind of change it while you're playing. Now we get a little bit more technical. We bundle the engine with the project. This is a very dirty thing, but in our Git repository, the version of the engine we're using is in there. How many people are doing this in their projects? Yeah, nice. So what does it mean is that the engine comes with the project, and it has a lot of positive side effects. Very easy to set up and run. You can seamlessly change the engine version without telling anybody in most of the engine upgrades, which you should do. And for anybody who has done this kind of in other engines or in Godot as well, this can be a very annoying process. You have to kind of go on Discord and tell everybody, hey, the next time you kind of, if you pull, you need to go to this link, download this version of the game, and then run it. And also, you can seamlessly change to a custom engine or a custom version. You need a debug version of the build because you have certain bugs that don't show up. You just hot swap this version. No more what version are we on? No more please upgrade. And it creates seamless cooperation with freelancers. You don't have this thing anymore. The first thing a freelancer comes in, you have to go, you have to find this specific version of Godot. It's actually on the website. You need to go other versions, find that link, whatever. It's incredibly useful. And the other thing it's useful for is if you have a build pipeline, you don't need to kind of manage two repositories or whatever version tracking. The build pipeline has the build there. Everything you need to create a package is right there with you. The trade-off, $5. For the whole company, yeah. So Bip and Biz runs on $5 LTS cost to support that. So let's get to the last part of my talk, which is kind of the more layering on top. That was how we use Godot, and this is how do we kind of advance Godot. This is the most important one. Per project start option. So both for Dome Keeper and PBKK, we don't use the normal play button. We have this extension to the editor where we just kind of pick where you want to start. In Dome, actually, I don't know who between Chris and Austin did it, they actually also supported multiplayer. So suddenly, you want to test something, you skip the first 30 to 40 seconds of your test session, where you know you boot the normal game, and then you go into the loadout, and you pick which keeper you want to do, and then you load the game, by just kind of clicking these drop-downs. And in PBKK, for example, we have a lot of missions, and you can often, the thing you want to test is just at a specific mission, and you can just jump to it. And in the future, we might do things like certain bugs only happen if you bought certain upgrades, certain specific things. Well, we can prepare save files or kind of cheat code for it, and then just add an option, what kind of upgrades that you want to have, like nothing, random selection, things like that. And then suddenly, it really speeds up that kind of testing iteration loop. How many of you are doing something like this in your game? All right, good. YAML. This is another thing we do, and this is again goes back to the kind of the Unity to Godot thing. When I see Unity developers try Godot for the first time, they try to put all of their data in engine because that's kind of how you use those engines. They try to create like these constant kind of structures, that, like nested resources, references, and Godot isn't good at that yet. But also, it's just not the best way to do it. So another thing we do is we just go very old school and take some of these responsibilities away from the engine and move it to something that we have more direct design control over. In PBKK, what we do, this is our mission definition. And what it means is that if you want to make a new mission for the game, you just kind of take a block, add these properties, and actually the entirety of the level design is those four lines in spawn plan. That's the level. And we do some special things, for example, those lines there, like this lander M 10.0 minus 1,000. Well, that supports kind of dynamic properties, and we can customize it. So this is saying, I'm spawning a ship of type lander. This is a class, like a node somewhere, a scene, I don't know, after 10 seconds at position minus 1,600. And we can dynamically add some properties like that ID is equal to target. And what this allows us to do is kind of completely speed up this design development pipeline by just taking ownership of this part of the game, moving it to something we have full control over, and then parsing it in Godot and kind of stepping over the engine and saying, Godot, you're great, but you're not great at this, and we can make it tailor-made for us. And this is another example. We use this system everywhere. The shop, every item in the shop is also kind of defined in this kind of structure. It's a very normal thing to do. But we can see that we can customize the data and kind of specify it the way we want to use it. The event was, I think I will skip this one for time reasons, but maybe it's very important. So this goes to a very big problem kind of in programming, one of the most important thing you do, which is kind of this dependency change of how is your data, how is your execution flowing from one point to another. And games can be very interconnected in a way that we don't like as software engineers. So you want your gameplay code to trigger an UI execution, and then you want to wait for the UI and then trigger the gameplay code again. This is hate from us as a software engineer. You don't want this, but game design wise, you should do this more often because often it feels good that the game is more reactive, more responsive. So you have to write that kind of code, and the way we write that kind of code is we have this data event bus which create kind of indirect dependencies. And here is how it works. This is the full implementation of our subtitle system. In gameplay, I just say, hey, I want to change the UI subtitle to this line of text. And the subtitle system just says, yeah, okay, label.text is equal to text. End of implementation. So I'm skipping the entirety dependency chain of, you know, how would I get that otherwise? Well, the radio system, if we go full software architecture, we need either some kind of service provider, we need to find a way, or the dependency should be injected. So I have a reference to an I subtitle displayer or an I kind of UI feedback or whatever you want to call it. And I need to solve that whole kind of architecture graph and go all the way down, or you just do this stupid thing. And it's string-based. It's slow, like performance-wise, this is very slow. The multiplayer guys might know something about it. And you could make it faster, but it's really fast to implement, and I will give somebody, maybe I won't do that, but The amount of times you're CPU bottlenecked in modern games, you need to do a very specific subset of games to be CPU bottlenecked. Maybe something with a lot of entities doing very complex things. But most kind of normal casual games, they don't even get close. Even when you use a GDScript, 20 times slower than writing it in C++ or something like that, with some insane costs, you never even get close to it. So this kind of cost doesn't matter. Yeah, necessary factorial reference. This is kind of, you know, the same problem space of having to sort your dependency chains. And the top left one is, if you've played Factorio, that's clearly the way to do it. But sometimes just a little bit of chaos doesn't actually impact the high level kind of side effects. And it's just a million times easier to write. All right, 4 more minutes. We have a build pipeline. Who here has an automated build pipeline? Yeah. We wrote it very quickly. It runs fully on GitHub. It just kind of clones the repo, makes a build, runs automatic tests, makes an automatic Steam upload. And it also does this nice thing that it just tags kind of what build on Steam is which version. And I have this line down here, because back when I started joining Domekeeper, we had this dynamic where the only person that knew how to make builds and made builds was René, CEO, lead designer. And he was managing a company, being the lead designer, fixing bugs, doing everything. And then periodically, QA would have to be like, hey, René, can you stop everything you're doing to make me this build, which he'd do by hand, go use kind of the Steam API to upload it manually. And then if you're fixing bugs, QA would be, was this fixed? And you go, I don't know when René made this build. Maybe he made it at 11 in the morning. I don't know. And by doing this kind of steps, and it's easy to set up pipelines right now. I mean, JetBrains talked yesterday about they have their own CI/CD stuff. You can use it native. There's a lot of tools for this. This is not the problem it used to be. And for us, this has saved us an infinite amount of time. If you have a big enough company, don't do this if you're one guy. Don't go like, I'm going to make a beautiful build pipeline. This is about saving time in the long run as a developer. I don't want to ever have to do a build. You know, I want to write code. I want to do this stuff I'm good at. I don't want to be the person who's like, oh yeah, let me go press export. And then another thing that happens obviously is reliability. If it's running with the same architecture, same execution every time, they're consistent. This is very useful. If you're making builds on your machine, oh, did you forget a change? Did you not revert everything? Is there some bad cache that you're carrying from 7 versions ago that suddenly makes its way into your build and it breaks some kind of data? These things happen. We have an in-game bug reporter. What it does is you can just write something in the game, click a button, and it uploads it to Jira, and it adds a save file. It adds the logs, it takes a screenshot. Yeah, this is everything. The amount of time QA spends chasing down reasons for bugs, writing people like, hey, but in which version were you? What's your platform? This is really easy. People love it. They feel like they're part of the development. It has a positive player experience. And it's just really, really useful to save me time so that I don't have to do this shit. And the last one, but not least, is I've made an audio debugger. And what it does is kind of just tells you what you're hearing. And this is a bigger problem than people think about. Because the normal audio development pipeline is, you have your sound engineer, they want to play a sound. Maybe they're not technical, maybe they're technical. But often an engineer implements it. And then you play the game and you don't hear it. And there's like 10 reasons why you don't hear it. The programmer forgot to do it. The audio engineer forgot to do it. They did it, but it's wrong. They did it, but there's a bug. They did it, but it's restarting every frame. So theoretically, it's playing, but it's kind of restarting. And just by having something like this, the audio engineer themselves, when they get a ticket or a bug about sound problems, they just use this. They look, can I hear the thing I'm supposed to hear? OK, it's there. It's playing. I just don't hear it. OK, so maybe it's just tuned too far down. Or you see it's not playing. It's a tech bug. So it allows you to kind of skip the whole very iterative, complex problem of taking an engineer's time who's supposed to kind of build your game and have him spend kind of this time tracing down why the sound wasn't working. Last but not least, not an advertisement, but it should be. Use Sentry. They have Godot integration now. Godot is really bad at crashes. It's really bad at kind of telling you why something crashed. It crashes. It doesn't say anything. Sentry fixes that in most of the cases. It's a kind of a service, obviously, professional thing, and it's made exactly to kind of track sources of issues in kind of big software. Another way we use it, which you should also do. Actually, how many people here are using Sentry? Okay. How many people here know what Sentry is? Okay, yeah. Obviously, it's not always the case. This is a thing we haven't been doing for a long time, and it's something that only becomes relevant at a specific size. But if you are at that size, or even if you just need to release, if you're going to release a game, you want to know why it crashes, you want to know how often it crashes. Right now, this is the way to do it. There's not a good alternative. I'm over my time. I'm going to say a last sentence. The other way we use it, which is a little bit of a hack, but that's kind of the whole thing of the talk, is that we also send save load failures or save load issues to the Sentry thing. And this is a complex problem when you release a game that has a long story, which is any kind of bug in that system is going to be completely experience breaking. It can remove like 10 hours of gameplay. I've had this personally when Shadow Gambit released. I spent 3 days after that. I fixed the bug. It was an hour. It was a stupid bug, but it was just complexity. And then I spent 2 days manually fixing people's save files because they lost like 10 to 15 hours of progress because of the one line of code. And normally, you don't get this reported because sometimes the save just continues. Like, it just doesn't realize it failed, and then they're playing on a broken version of your game. This is like the worst outcome. You'd much rather they just can't play because then a week later, they go, oh, the game is completely broken, but actually it broke a week ago, and you will never find the cause. So we just kind of, when the save load system fails, we just send it to the Sentry, and then periodically you can look at it, and we just can find out why we're failing, and we send the save file, we send where it failed, all the data we needed. Yeah, last but not least, you know, now I'm talking about speed and speed to make better games, and now I've talked about tools, but this shouldn't be, you shouldn't get out of this room thinking, oh, now I'm going to build these tools. You should, it was really about productivity, and I pretty much showed a lot of the tools we have. I'm not showing you the top 10. I'm kind of showing you like half of our tools. Because a lot of the time, you know, especially software developers, we love building tools. They're fun, they're cool, they're small. And we overestimate how good we are, like how quickly we can write it. And we overestimate what the return of investment. You go like, yeah, we're going to use this every day, all the time. And very often it's not the case. So my rule of my thumb rule is, it should be 10 times, you should think that you get 10 times the reward. Because the reality is it's gonna take you 3 times more to write it anyways, because you don't plan iteration time, you don't plan like the whole thing. And it's gonna be half as useful as you think. So yes. All right. Thank you very much.